welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Robert Salas. I also need to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the 4-digit station ID code 2899. I also would like to mention that everyone keep their thoughts and prayers of my fellow host, UPRN host Angela Joyner. She's going to be having surgery soon, and we all, you know, keep her in our thoughts and prayers that she makes a speedy recovery. Also, congratulations to Dwayne Tudall, the producer of some of the UFO Files episodes, and his wife, as they are expecting a new baby. From what I understand, she went into labor yesterday, and probably, you know, they have a new little one. So congratulations, Dwayne Tudall and your wife. Hope you enjoy this little one as all new parents do. And my guest tonight, Captain Robert Salas, retired, served on active duty with the Air Force for 7 years after graduating from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1964. He served at Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida, before his assignment at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, in 1966. He earned a master's degree in aerospace engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. He also worked with the Titan III missile system program office at Los Angeles AFS. After being honorably discharged from the Air Force in 1971, Mr. Salas briefly worked as an engineer for Martin Marietta Aerospace and Rockwell International. From 1974 until his retirement in 1995, Mr. Salas worked for the Federal Aviation Administration as an aircraft structures engineer. Mr. Salas has spoken publicly about the 1967 UFO missile shutdown since 1995. He is co-author of the book, Faded Giant, and I am pleased and honored to welcome Mr. Salas as my guest this evening. Oh, what an exciting incident to be involved with.
Yes, thank you, Dee. Thank you for having me, and I'm excited to be here and talk at length about my incident. I'll let you start with any questions you have on that.
Well, the first thing that I think of when the incident happened, and you got that call from the topside gate guard of an object hovering outside the gate, what was going through your mind?
Well, actually, the first call I got was from the main guard who said that he and other guards up there, there were about five or six of them, were just kind of looking outside in the night sky, and they were seeing some strange lights. They were flying erratically, very fast across the sky, and making strange maneuvers, 90-degree turns, and stopping on a dime, and things like that, and that's what he told me, that first call, and I just kind of dismissed it as kind of, you know, they must be real bored up there or something. anyway, I didn't pay much attention to it. And then I got the second call about 5 minutes later, and that time he was really anxious. You know, he was screaming into the phone and saying that he and his guards were out there, and the guards had their weapons drawn. Looking at a glowing red oval-shaped object that was just hovering right outside our front gate. And so it was just sitting there, pulsating a red light. He said it was hard to ask him if he could describe the shape or any details of it. He said he couldn't at that time. So, then he said he had to go when the guards got injured, hung up the phone, and went to talk to my commander about it. He was in a rest period, so he was taking a nap. And just as I was about to tell him about the calls, our missile started going into what's called a no-go situation, an unlaunchable mode. It just shut down. So that basically was the incident. We'll give you more detail, of course.
Oh, what did you think? What was going through your mind when he said that there was a UFO hovering outside the gate?
Well, you know, it's something you don't expect to hear. So I was kind of in shock, especially when he asked me what they ought to do about it. I think I told him something like, don't let anything inside the perimeter fence. But, yeah, it was a shock to me, too. I didn't quite know what to think at that time. Although I will say this, as I hung up the phone with him, after that second call, it occurred to me that something was trying to shut down our missiles. It was kind of like a feeling, a strong feeling that might happen. And of course it did.
Did they shut down in rapid succession, or?
Yes, in rapid succession, one right after the other. So, which is very unusual, as I mentioned in the book. This was very rare. We had a very reliable system and a redundant system. And so it was very rare for these missiles to shut down for any reason. For example, the power system was triply redundant. We had commercial power, and then we had a backup generator, and we had batteries. So any of those would have kicked in if one of them failed. So this was very unusual.
And what would have been the standard procedure for even just one missile shutting down on its own, let alone?
Well, of course, we would have sent a security team out there to the site. Remember, the launch facilities are located about a mile or two away from the launch control center. So we would have sent a security team out there to check things out and then called maintenance. I reported to the command post right away and called maintenance and get the maintenance people out there. I mean, these missiles were supposed to be at the ready at all times. So that was our mission, to keep those missiles ready to go.
Now, and it wasn't just one flight of missiles, was it?
That requires a little bit of explanation. When our missiles went down, we reported it to the command post, and I recall vividly my commander, Fred Mywald, reported to the command post, which would have been back at Great Falls Base, Malmstrom Air Force Base. And he turned to me after that call and said the same thing happened at another flight. Now, okay, and that's what I remember, from my recollection of memory. And so when I went to write the book, initially I thought that that was Echo flight that went down on the same day that our flight went down. So I wrote the book thinking that Echo and Oscar flight was where I was located. Both went down on the same morning. Just from that vivid recollection I had of him turning to me and saying that. But as it turned out, what he meant to say was that a flight had gone down previously in the same way. So, and that's what my position is today, is that we do know the exact date of the Echo flight shutdown. That was March 16th. 1967, and we're honing in on being pretty sure that the Oscar flight, the flight that I was at, went down on March 24th, and I'm saying that because we've got a couple of witnesses now telling us that they recall vividly the 24th, because there was another incident called the Belt UFO sighting, which I do talk about in my book also, that went down on the 24th. So, and that these maintenance people went out to bring Oscar back up on the 24th. I hope that makes sense. It can be a little confusing.
Actually, it does. So the Minot, North Dakota incident and the Malmstrom, Montana incident happened roughly at the same time?
Well, Minot, there was one incident at Minot that's pretty well documented. That happened in August of 1966. So it preceded Malmstrom by a few months. And then my memory serves, there was another incident in December of 66 at Minot. But I think especially the August incident at Minot is very well documented, and there's it was part of the Blue Book files and well documented as to what happened there. Basically, UFOs were sighted over missile sites and also the Missile Launch Control Center, and disrupted communications. And also there was, I believe, a B-47 crew that saw the UFO from the air. So that's another incident that's well documented and supported by multiple witnesses.
In your researching the effects of UFOs and missiles, has there been any other missile bases other than just Malmstrom and Minot?
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to mention the book written by Robert Hastings. It's UFOs and Nukes. And in there he catalogs quite a few incidents around missile bases. And matter of fact, I've got a list right here in front of me. And he lists the witnesses also. So we have incidents at Walker Air Force Base, which is in New Mexico. And those were Atlas missiles, but they were also ICBMs, of course. So we've got that. We've got Whiteman in 66 and 67. Grand Forks. Vandenberg Air Force Base. Francis E. Warren in Wyoming. Ellsworth Air Force Base. I think that's in South Dakota. So there are quite a few incidents involving missiles and UFOs. And like I said, Hastings does an excellent job in his book of going through those details, and he's talked to many witnesses. Matter of fact, he counted something close to 100 witnesses, ex-military, at these and other bases that have talked about UFO flyovers over nuclear facilities.
That's a lot of facilities. I didn't realize there was that many.
Well, yeah, close to 100 witnesses.
I'm also noticing in your book, too, that the foreword was written by Raymond Fowler.
Right.
And he also has an interesting connection to the Minuteman program shut down by UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ray Fowler was working for Sylvania in 1966-67. And He got wind of through his sources at Malmstrom Air Force Base, because Sylvania had a contract with the Air Force. It had to do with electrical systems, I believe. They had a contract with the Air Force on Minuteman, so he had civilian contractors on site at Malmstrom. And so when the Echo flight shutdown occurred, he got notified by his people on site, and so he knew about it early on. And so he was very instrumental, actually, in getting this Echo incident disclosed. He also was instrumental in notifying the one of the investigators in the Condon Committee, which I can talk about later at length. His name is Dr. Roy Craig. He was one of the investigators on the Edward Condon investigation that the Air Force had contracted University of Colorado with in 1966. But he was the first one that notified that committee about the Echo shutdowns. And he also had wrote a story for the Christian Science Monitor. Almost got him in trouble with his bosses and almost lost him his job. But he did do that. And as a result of that, the story that he wrote in 1973, I believe it was, Timothy Good picked up that information and put it in his book, Above Top Secret, which I think was published around 1991 or 93, something in that neighborhood. But that's how I got involved in this, because I was sworn to secrecy after the incident that occurred to me. I couldn't talk about it, and of course I was obliged to follow my security oath, even after I had left the Air Force. So, but as a result of that, right up in Timothy Good's book, Above Top Secret, I felt, I thought at the time that I had been at Echo Flight, because they described the incident that I had to a T, and I hadn't heard about the Echo incident. I really hadn't occurred to me that another flight had gone down. Until, like I said, I recovered that memory, but it took a while to recover memories. That's one of the problems with dealing with classified information. You're best off just trying to forget it. And so that's what I did all those years from the time after the incident until about 1995, when I picked up that book Above Top Secret. I saw that write-up that Good had on the Echo flight shutdown. And at that point, I contacted MUFON and asked to talk to one of their investigators. And that's how I met Jim Klotz, my co-author, and terrific investigator. And it was Klotz at my instigation that submitted a request under the Freedom of Information Act to the Air Force about information involving the Echo flight shutdowns. We didn't say anything about UFOs. We just, knew that the Echo had shut down under strange circumstances and wanted to see if the Air Force could release information. Well, as it turned out, the Air Force wrote back, said, this is classified, but since it's been so long and since you requested it, we're going to declassify the incident, the Echo shutdown incident. And so they did. Started sending the documents. So we kind of got the ball rolling from there.
There's a question that has been posted in our virtual auditorium here in Paltalk by Linda Keeper.
Uh-huh.
And she was curious if you thought that there were extraterrestrials behind this incident.
I do. I think the objects were not made on Earth. We didn't have technology to do something like what they did, and I don't think we still do. I think the technology was so far advanced that it only stands to reason. I'm just going from logic and reason. That's my viewpoint. It just stands to reason that since these objects couldn't have been constructed on Earth or developed on Earth, they must be of extraterrestrial origin. So absolutely, that is my position. I think they are extraterrestrial.
Gossamer would also like to know if you think there's a connection as far as the ET's action between the events at missile bases and other bases that have nuclear weapons on site, for example, the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Would you repeat that just real quick?
Certainly.
The first part.
Do you think there's a connection as far as the ET's action between the events at missile bases and other bases that have nuclear weapons on site, for example, the Rendlesham Forest incident?
Oh, yes, absolutely there's a connection. I asked Colonel Hult by email whether or not the object that he saw had any interest in the nuclear weapons storage area, we call the weapons storage area for nukes. And he said yes. The UFO hovered over that and actually, I believe he said, displayed a light, shone a light on the weapons storage area. The same thing happened at Alviano Air Base in Italy, 1977. There was a UFO sighting there over the base, and it also hovered over the weapons storage area. And, of course, they hovered over our area and our nuclear weapons during my incident and the Echo incident. So the connection here is that I think they're drawing attention to nuclear materials, nuclear weapons specifically. They're just pointing to them. To me, that's a message that it's a undeniable message in my mind that they're telling us that we know you've got these weapons. We can disable them, at times, but basically. We need to get rid of these weapons. Otherwise, we're going to destroy ourselves, which is obvious, I think, to anybody that's really thought about this. And, it's encouraging to me that I think our current President Obama and the Soviet Union, though I mean not the Soviet Union, the Russia, is making an effort to reduce the stockpile of nuclear weapons, and that Obama's objective is to reduce it to zero, which is heartening.
Did I hear you say frightening?
Heartening.
Heartening. I'm sorry. It sounded like you said frightening. I apologize.
No, I'm really happy to see that.
I am, too. The idea of having nuclear weapons hanging over our heads, so to speak, is very frightening.
Yes.
There's another question here from our virtual auditorium that I think is a valid question. This is from Jim Light, and Jim would like to know what was the time lapse between each missile shutting down and how many missiles were shut down in all?
Okay, well, I can tell you, in my case, the missiles went down, within seconds of each other. So there was very little time lapse. My commander has a little different recollection of how many missiles shut down than I do. I have believed and still believe that all 10 of them shut down. And he thought it was more like 6 to 8 of them. But, and then in the Echo incident, all 10 did shut down. That was confirmed not only by the commander and the deputy commander of the launch control facility, but by correspondence that we have, documents that we have. All 10 of them shut down. It said within seconds of each other, within Within 10 seconds, all of them were down. Now, this is a pretty amazing feat because the cabling system for control of these weapons is buried about 60 feet underground. I know our capsule was 60 feet underground. And these are triply redundant cables. In other words, they were shielded. They were triple shielded from electromagnetic interference. And so whatever they were able to do is pretty amazing that they were able to do this. And in addition to that, just about all these missiles were shut down for about the same cause, and that was guidance and control system failure. All in all, it was a pretty amazing thing to have happen, and certainly couldn't have happened incidentally or by accident.
Another quick question here from our virtual auditorium. This is from Linda Keeper, and she would like to know, let me get this so I can read it all. She says she was just wondering if UFOs are shutting down American missiles or missiles in all countries.
Well, in my book, I also talk about an incident that happened in the Soviet Union, Russia. And in that case, there was interference with the missile, and actually started the missile on a launch sequence. And again, this was a nuclear missile. Now, this is pretty dramatic. The missile actually started to go through a launch procedure and then stopped. I don't know how far in, but it stopped. And this is, again, has been documented. As a matter of fact, it was the subject of an ABC special. I can't remember the year, but it's identified in my book. So that I know that has happened. I've heard rumors that the same thing happened to a French missile, but I don't know the details of that. But that's about all the information I can give you on that.
I just find it amazing, too, as a child, I grew up in Southern California, not far from the Vandenberg site. And I remember as a kid watching Minuteman test launches.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been 65, 66, 67 in that era.
Yeah.
And then I hear about the footage that Jacobs took of an object shooting down a missile.
Well, actually, what happened was the object flew around a dummy nose cone. A missile was launched, and Jacobs was there to film the launching and film the separation, different stages of the separation for the nose cone, and to see. This was a test firing to see how accurate it could hit a target area that was in the Pacific Ocean. It was just a test. But when they developed the film, what they saw was a UFO circling the nose cone part, which would have been, was simulated the warhead of the missile, and shooting a beam of light at it, and displacing its trajectory so much that it missed its target during the test. So that is pretty amazing. But again, that was substantiated by his boss, Major Mansman. And there was film footage taken and Mansman has talked about the CIA confiscating the film, so presumably somewhere in the CIA vaults they have this on film.
This is another question from our virtual auditorium. You've got people coming up with questions left and right tonight.
Okay.
This is from Joseph Z, who I personally know is ex-Air Force himself. And he would like to know if you noticed any abnormal events such as unused coaxial cables arcing over.
I mean, during my incident?
Yes.
No, we did not have any unusual arcing that I could see inside the capsule. So the answer is no, I didn't notice anything like that.
Well, some of the questions that are coming out of our virtual auditorium this evening is kind of got me off guard. I'm surprised. This is an incident that is amazing. Joseph has a backup question he would like to ask. If there was any problems with your communication system.
Yes. After we reported the missile shutdowns, we sent guards out to a couple of the sites because we also had security violations at a couple of the sites. We had lights on our control panel there for a security violation. In other words, some kind of an incursion. So we sent guards out a couple of sites, and while they were out there, they observed UFOs again. They saw them. And at that time, they also had a breakdown in their UHF-VHF communications with our security guards. So, that is typical of UFO sightings, where they interfere with communications.
I've heard off of reading in your book that a possible electromagnetic pulse is what shut down these systems. Was that ever confirmed?
Well, what happened is we were able to contact two Boeing engineers that had been identified in the one of the telexes. And one of the Boeing engineers recalls running a bench test, in other words, a test in a laboratory, and he tried to simulate a possible failure mode of the some piece of the equipment, and he was able to simulate a failure as a result of electromagnetic pulse, what's called EMP or electromagnetic pulse or input. And he even identified the energy level and the frequency of the pulse. And so that was something he offered as speculation as to what was the physical component that caused the shutdowns. But he couldn't come up with any possible source for that kind of a pulse. In other words, there was nothing that could have caused that internal. Matter of fact, I was just noticing in my appendix that there is a statement from the Air Force, one of the documents, that said that whatever caused this thing had to have been external in origin. Not internal. Okay.
That kind of confirms what everybody would think or was thinking was the reason for how people's cars shutting down during sightings and
mm-hmm.
radio, and all kinds of weird electronics problems during sightings.
Yeah, I'm not sure I bring it up in my book, but I will tell this story because it's really interesting. And it comes from one of the targeting officers who was tasked to go out and restart one of the Echo flight birds. and he was down in the hole, as we say, and where the missile was located, going through a test and a procedure, actually, to bring the missile back up to a launchable condition. And at one point, he heard from his guard upstairs. He had a security guard upstairs at the ground level, and the guard asked him to come up. He went up, saw this UFO, orange pulsing ball, and it was not too far away, but in the sky, and he went back down. Actually, he said he wasn't afraid, really, and he noted the object and then went back down and continued his work. But every time he'd get to a certain point in his procedure, the missile was shut down again. He could not complete his procedure, and he recalls feeling the some kind of energy coming down into the missile tube, and he said he could actually feel it was kind of like static electricity. But it's an amazing story.
Oh, wow. Can you feel the energy coming down the missile tube?
Yes. He said
oh.
He could actually feel it was like a rope of energy. So, and this is, to me, he's a very credible witness. It's just that he cannot publicly disclose his name at this point. Hopefully someday he will. But he happens to hold a pretty good job at a defense contractor, and he doesn't want to jeopardize his position.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
In your book, you have page after page after page of documents to back up, you know, your story. And I'm, like, just flipping through them now, and, you know, there's just so many of them. This has got to be one of the most well-documented incidences that I've ever seen.
Well, thank you. I hope so. We tried. We tried to document everything we said. And like I said, we do have additional correspondence, which we didn't include in there. But I did include statements from various witnesses. So all the whole body of evidence is the witness statements and the documentation. And to me, you know, people say, you know, skeptics say, where's the evidence? These things exist. Well, you know, this is evidence. It would be allowable in a court of law, you know, people's testimonies and documents. You know, how do you prove the truth? You know, how much proof do you really need? So I do think it's a well corroborated case.
Another thing that's been brought up in our virtual auditorium, a lot of people were saying, is this the same guy that was with Greer's Disclosure Project?
Yeah, it's the same guy. I was at the first Disclosure Conference in 2001, invited by Dr. Greer. I don't know how far do you want to go into this subject. Do you want me to extrapolate on that?
Well, I think you and I are pretty close to the same opinion of what of Stephen Greer at the moment. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned that I did write an article, and people are probably aware of this, criticizing people like Michael Sala and Stephen Greer, and the reason I did that is because it was not intended to be a personal attack. I met both these gentlemen, of course, and they're very likable and knowledgeable and are sincere, I believe, in their efforts of wanting disclosure. However, when they make wild statements, such as I mentioned in that correspondence, what they're doing is contributing to the concept that this subject is laughable, something to be ridiculed, you know, and not taken seriously. And that's really the battle we're fighting. That's the public perception. We need to get mainstream media and the public as a whole taking this seriously. And that's the reason I criticized their activities. That was my purpose, try and get them to realize that, you know, if we're going to really make inroads towards disclosure, then we've got to start playing smarter.
I agree. I think Stephen Greer started off great and then dropped the ball.
Yeah.
Big time. I have another question here for you. This one's from Paul Dwarf, and he would like to know if you have information about other bases being visited that don't have nuke capabilities, and does, I believe this is supposed to be, does he have any opinions about why they were visiting these bases, U.S. or foreign?
Do I have an opinion as to why they're visiting these bases?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I believe I alluded to before. To me, my incident was, bottom line, was a message. And the message was, we are here. We know how to shut down your missiles. We know all about your missiles. We know you have nuclear weapons, and that they are very dangerous to your existence. And the shutdown of the missiles, to me, indicated that, you know, you need to shut these babies down. Just shut them down and get rid of them. and, you know, I think the world has kind of wakened up to that concept that, you know, these are very, very dangerous weapons, and could annihilate every living thing on the planet. You know, we have over 20,000 active, ready-to-go nuclear weapons in the world today, right now, as we speak. 20,000. Well, it doesn't take, you know, one of these could absolutely obliterate a city like Los Angeles. Can you think of 20,000 other major cities? I mean, this would just be a horrendous disaster to a planet and every living thing on it. There's got to be a better way to secure ourselves.
This one is again from Joseph Z, and he would like me to tell you, thank you for the diffuse orange ball. Yes, there was an exceptional amount of static, electrostatic effects. Just exactly what he means by that, I'm not sure, but he just wanted me to make sure to tell you that he said thank you.
Yes. Yeah, by the way, if any of your listeners want to contact me, they can do so. I'll give you my email address if you want it now or later. But
certainly.
I'd love to hear from any of them, especially any of them that have been ex-military or had any military experiences. I'll make an announcement later on in the program about a program we're going to be working on here shortly. But they can write to me at rsolace15@roadrunner.com. rsolace15@roadrunner.com.
And I understand that you're also involved in the peace and space movement.
peace in space movement. Not that I know of. Could you expand on that?
Well, I mean, you're a supporter of peace in space.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a supporter of not weaponizing space, if that's what you're talking about, not having space-based weapons. This goes back to disclosure and government secrecy. If the government is working on space-based weapons, then it's again something that the public should be involved in making, informed of, at least the decision to do that and have a dialogue about that, because we're talking about things that could do much damage to the planet.
Again, that's something I agree with 100%. Another question here from Gemlight, and Gem would like to know if any outside contractors, not military, came to visit the damage to the missiles after the occurrence, and if so, who?
Yes. Boeing, for one, had an investigative team. I worked with Robert Kaminsky, who was the lead investigator for the Boeing team. They worked to try to find out the cause of the shutdowns, and they looked at all aspects, including power and interference with computers, even the people involved, whether or not they were stable or could have been lying or things like that. There was an extensive investigation, and the Boeing team concluded that they couldn't come up with a definitive cause for the shutdowns, and they did many tests in the capsules and out in the field. As a matter of fact, I know from a reliable source that as late as 1972, the Air Force was still trying to figure out what exactly caused those shutdowns, and they hadn't as of 1972.
Wow. Again, people have been asking for the name of the book, and it's Faded Giant by Robert Ballas and James Klotz.
Right, Faded Giant, right. And they can get it on Amazon. And if anybody's in Southern California, next Saturday I'll be speaking in Ventura at a UFO conference in Ventura. And I'll have books there. So I get that plug in.
Okay, awesome. I wish I could be there. here's another question, and I've got it in a colored text that's difficult for me to read. This is from Carr, and Carr would like to know, have any of the guards involved come forward to verify this?
Yeah, we do have one guard especially that talked about observing a UFO about the same time period, but I have not been able to locate any of the guards at either Echo or Oscar flight. Now, except, like I said, the maintenance man that I just mentioned. But the guards, no, we haven't been able to locate those. Now, again, this was during the Vietnam War. Many of those guards were shipped off to Vietnam because of their weapons training. So I imagine some of them didn't come back. But, we're still looking for those guards.
Well, if any of the guards are listening, please contact Robert. He'd love to talk to you.
Please, yes.
Definitely. How do you feel about all these military people that were, such as yourself, sworn to secrecy, now coming forward? For example, Milton Torres. He had kept his mouth shut for a good many years and felt that, well, the British government has come open with it. I feel I'm now released from my security oath. How do you feel about these people that are now coming out and saying, you know, talking about their incidences and what they know?
Well, I think it's fantastic. I'll mention that, well, maybe I better not mention that, but there are people that are still in the Air Force that are talking about incidents that are going on, you know, recently, and but they're unable to come forward for a couple of reasons. One is the security oath, and the other is the it's called a personnel reliability program, PRP, where they you know, they rate your performance based on whether or not you tell wild stories or not, and so they're afraid of talking about UFO incidents because of that. It might affect their careers. But no, I think it's great that we've had people come forward, you know, and I hope I've inspired some to do just that. Like you said, I actually signed an oath not to talk about this incident, and this was right after my incident occurred. I reported to my commander, and in his office was a man from AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigation. They asked me to sign a security oath not to talk about this to anybody, and so I didn't. And that's why I didn't talk. You know, one of the guards came to me later, within a week, and begged me to talk to him because he was so distraught over the whole thing, and I just couldn't do it because of this oath. So, like I said, I didn't talk about it until I thought that the incident had been declassified, and then at that point, when it was declassified, then I felt a release from that oath. So I've been talking about it ever since, for about 15 years.
Oh, here's a very good question. This is, again, from Gossamer. And he would like to know if you think being asked to sign this oath violated your constitutional rights.
No. No. Once you're in the military, you're under Uniform Code of Military Justice. Some of your constitutional rights are not in part of, you know, being in the military. You do have to follow orders. You do have to, you know, do as you're told. So this was basically an order that I was not to talk about this. So not, I wouldn't consider it a violation of my constitutional rights. No.
I have to agree with you on that. Being ex-Navy myself, I understand. And Gossamer says thank you for answering that honestly. And on that note, it's time for us to go to a break. And we'll be back in 9 to 10 minutes with Robert Salas here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 in New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight I've been speaking with Robert Salas. Robert, we've got a couple of more questions that have people are waiting to get asked. And we'll get to those real quick, and then after that, you have an announcement you'd like to make, and I'm on pins and needles to find out what that is.
Okay.
So let's get these questions going, shall we?
Sure.
This is from Time Forgotten, and Time would like to know, was there any activity by the Air Force to modify missiles to mitigate the potential of a possible reoccurrence of the shutdown? If there was, it would indicate the higher echelons had recognized the occurrence.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about that is we were not privy to that. Like I said, the Air Force was still trying to determine the definitive cause for these shutdowns in 1972. By 72, I was out of the Air Force, but even while I was there, this incident happened in 67. I was there until 69 at Malmstrom Air Force Base. And normally, we went on alert every 3 days or so, and we would have a briefing before going on alert of any problems with the weapons or studies that were being done, etc. And I never heard one word about my shutdown or the Echo shutdown or what they were doing about it or how they were trying to modify the systems. So I'm sure the Air Force by now has, we've gone to different, more advanced systems, and but whether or not they've actually come up with a fix to keep this from happening again, I do not know. Don't have that information.
Honest answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this next one is from Tall Dwarf, and Tall Dwarf would like to know if you have any information on service personnel becoming sick from these shutdowns or events that are similar.
Well, I'll relate one incident. I know this was a very frightening experience to those that were up close to these objects, and I know of one case where one of the guards went a little berserk in one of the neighboring towns as a result of having seen these objects, and they had to haul him away in a straitjacket, like they say. He just couldn't handle it. And again, I received one or two phone calls from my guards after the fact, begging me to come and talk to them about this, try to, give them some closure on the whole thing. And again, I was obligated not to talk to anybody, so I did not. But as far as any other kind of physical illness, I'm not aware of that. Just the mental aspect, the psychological aspect of dealing with this.
Oh, but that would be kind of hard on someone to have this happen just out of the blue, so to speak.
Right.
Okay, and one more question, and then we'll go to your announcement.
Okay.
This one's from Carr, and Carr would like to know if you have ever spoken to Jesse Marcel Jr., another former military officer, about UFOs.
No, I've never spoken to Jesse Marcel Jr. He's a very interesting and incredible man, and I'd love to have a chat with him sometime, but no, I haven't.
And that reminds me, too, I almost forgot. I hope everybody had a great Veterans Day, and a happy belated Veterans Day to you as well, and to all our veterans and active duty military. I myself am a Navy veteran myself, and I thank all our men and women who are overseas. May you all come back safely and soon. I'm dying to hear this. You have an announcement that you said you would like to make this evening, and I'm on.
Okay, well, about a month ago, I've been working with Robert Hastings. I mentioned his book, UFOs and Nukes, and at times we have been contacted by the History Channel and other media to come on their shows and present the evidence regarding UFOs and nuclear weapons and nuclear facilities. And after having been on some of these shows, we kind of lost control of the message. We didn't like the outcome, the way the show was eventually involved, we declined. We've been declining appearing on these things up to now. But we decided that it was time to have our own National Press Club conference of witnesses, specifically ex-military witnesses in the U.S. Where UFOs have been observed and where UFOs have interfered with our weapons, our nuclear weapons. So we're going to do that. We're going to organize this, and sometime in the future, we haven't decided the date yet. We're going to bring a group of witnesses at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and talk about this. So that's basically the announcement. We are going to try to. This is going to cost some money, and we're going to ask for donations at some point. And of course, if there are any witnesses out there that would like to participate in this, we haven't made a final selection of witnesses yet. But so if there's anyone out there that would like to participate and think they can contribute to this, the purpose, of course, is to try to get governmental disclosure. And then, of course, we'd love to hear from you. So that's basically it. I'm sorry about being vague about the date, but we're still organizing this thing, but we're determined that it's going to happen.
Awesome! Everybody in a lot of people in our virtual auditorium are going, oh, fantastic, good idea.
Yeah.
I've been noticing that the National Press Club there in D.C. has become pardon the expression, a popular place to do this type of thing, and I think it's great.
Well, thank you. We really are determined to get this done, and even if it takes a while.
I've had Robert Hastings on my program as well, and I thoroughly enjoyed that interview. He's very informative and very knowledgeable on the subject of UFOs and their interference with weapon systems.
Yeah, I agree. And he's been talking about this connection for a long time, even before I was. I think I know he's been making presentations at universities and across the country way before I started talking about it.
I think it's great. Well, when you have it all organized in a date set, be sure and let me know, and we'll get you back and.
Absolutely.
And we'll get, help get the word out there that it's going to be happening.
You bet.
This is awesome news.
Good.
I like to promote that kind of thing as much as I possibly can.
Very good.
You got a partial list of people who might be there, or?
Well, I'd rather not mention any names right now, but
okay.
We're going to try to get the best we can get, and hopefully these will be witnesses whose testimony has been corroborated again by either other witnesses or by documents. So what we're trying to do here is present good cases to the public. Cases that, like I said, have been corroborated and are pertinent, and specifically to the issue of UFOs being in and around facilities with nuclear materials and nuclear weapons. So all this will add to the base of information that we all need to, come to conclusions about. Some conclusions about this.
Will this just be concerning American nukes, or will it concern facilities from different countries?
Well, I don't think we're adverse to having witnesses from different countries if it involves, again, nuclear weapons or nuclear facilities. A lot of these sightings have occurred over nuclear power plants also. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Will there be, well, for example, have you looked into other connection cases like nuclear ships or nuclear-powered submarines and UFO encounters?
You know, I haven't. Maybe Mr. Hastings has, but I have not. By the way, in his book, he does talk about, and he may have mentioned this during your interview, about witnesses seeing UFOs during nuclear tests in Nevada and other places in the Pacific, and when the first hydrogen bomb test occurred, I think it was 1952, there were reports of UFOs in the area just before that test. So I think they're well aware of what we're doing and monitoring us.
Oh, interesting. I thank you for coming forward with what you know about what happened there at Malmstrom. And getting it out in the open, this book, Faded Giant, I found very informative. And like I said, the documents, holy cow, there are more documents in there than we have time to even mention. I wouldn't even know where to start on the pertinent documents you have in this book. Almost half the book itself is documents.
Right.
How long did it take you to get all of these documents and get them assembled?
Oh, well, let's see. We started about 1995, and I think our book was published in 2005, so 10 years. it took a while. It took a while to locate witnesses. Like I said, recovering memories also, it takes a while. Getting the facts clarified. So we wanted to make sure about all that. And even as recently as a month or so ago, we finally located the notes of Dr. Roy Craig, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
Dr. Roy Craig was I don't know if you'd call him a scientist, but he was assigned to the Conant Committee investigation. And he was notified by Ray Fowler of the Echo flight shutdowns. He came to Malmstrom Air Force Base in I think it was October of 1967. Again, the incidents occurred in the spring of 67. But the Conant Committee had heard about these incidents and should have thoroughly investigated them, of course, because that was their job. They were supposed to be investigating these kinds of things. At any rate, we were finally able to locate his notes, you know, personal notes that he took. They were at the Texas A&M University library. But in those notes, we were able to determine and I think I did write this up in a report that was on UFO Chronicles recently, the website, if anybody's interested in looking at that. But the bottom line is that Craig or the Conant Committee did not follow through on the ability to investigate this. And there were many witnesses available that they could have interviewed, and they didn't. And again, this goes to the question of whether or not this was a cover-up and were they involved in a whitewash. And so I think this new evidence that I've talked about just kind of nails that thing down, that it wasn't whitewashed, that there was a cover-up, and the Air Force was very much involved in this cover-up, because they wanted to get out of talking about the UFO business incidents, and so they did. At the end of the Conant Committee report, the Air Force said, Conant Committee doesn't think there's much to this, so we're going to bow out of any more discussion on UFOs. So officially, that's their position even today, that they no longer investigate these, they don't talk about it, really.
Yes, that's their standard answer to any UFO-related query anymore.
Right.
The infamous, I guess you could call it, swamp gas theory has now been replaced by flares.
Yeah, right. Flares and balloons.
Flares and balloons, yep.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question here from our virtual auditorium. And this one is from the nickname Secret Underground Bases. And Secret says, I would like to know the author's opinion on how they managed to build such massive secret underground bases and keep them secret.
Well, there are secret underground facilities in many places. The trick is to whoever's working on these places, even the civilian contractors, is say, basically your job depends on not talking about this. They do put even civilians under oath classification, and the penalties for breaking these oaths is severe. You know, we're talking about jail time, serious jail time, and fines. So, and losing your job. I mean, these are...
And security clearance, too.
And security clearance. These are very serious things to anybody. And so I don't find it amazing that they can keep these sorts of things secret. Yeah.
Oh, my. It just boggles the mind to think of how many people there are out there who are under a security oath that have information that could crack this wide open.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
It's mind-boggling. Is there anything that you personally learned from your experience, other than, everybody... With the extraterrestrial theory of these origins and all this, did it change your life a lot?
Well, yes, it has. I'm really focused on telling my story and trying to accomplish disclosure. I've tried, I've been at this again since. 1995, talking about it publicly, and many times I've tried to just walk away from it, thinking that, I've been on the Art Bell show, so I've done my part, or I've been on sightings, I've done my part, I've been on Larry King, I've done my part, telling my story. I've gone out and given talks at different symposiums and conferences, I could say to myself, I've done my part, but I keep coming back and doing interviews like what I'm doing now because I'm more or less committed. I had the experience. I feel obligated to share it to anybody that wants to listen. I really believe in what I'm doing. Because I think the public does have the right to know and a need to know. And if nothing else, like I said in the book, to protect our democracy, we need to have our government accountable and what they're doing. And here we've got the most important story in history, that there are beings from other places visiting our planet, and we need to be a part of the conversation. The public in general needs to be a part of that conversation. We cannot just leave it to a small group of elitists that think they know how to handle this whole thing.
How do you think we as just average, everyday American citizens can go about demanding, you know, I heard we use the same term, demanding disclosure? How do you think we could go about getting the government to come forward and say, okay, we know they're out there, we know they're extraterrestrial?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this is a tricky thing. The simplistic answer is write to your congressman, but the fact is, I've talked to congressmen. I've talked to senators. I've written to them. Face-to-face, I've talked to them. And this is a political issue. Anything like this would be a political issue. And so the way you get, a political issue, any political issue and get the Congress or the, you know, those in power to pay attention to it, is to keep pressing the valid or the substantive cases like my own. You know, I'm not trying to blow my horn, but you know what I'm saying. And again, this goes back to the criticism I had of others, and that is, if you keep this whole subject as one of ridicule, no one's going to pay attention, and so we have to keep pressing. Do whatever you can. You know, write to blogs, write to your congressman, support people that, you know, are really trying to get this message out, and keep pressing these points that. There are so many good cases out there to talk about, and so many, you know, responsible people that have come forward, that eventually, you know, maybe something will happen. You know, I take my hat off to Larry King, for example, for making this a serious subject. They're trying to make it a serious subject. Even though at times he plays some strange music.
Well, and then has the bunkers on there.
Right, right.
I think some of those are the most rude people. you know, screaming and yelling and all this. But right. You know, but again, I have to agree with you. Larry King has been doing some good work.
But that is another reason why we're going to go forward with our news conference. And again, we're really going to try to get mainstream media to cover that. And so we got to make sure that our documents are in order, that our stories are in order, and like I said, corroborated. We're going to require all our witnesses to sign a affidavit. You know, write down their incident with. What it's all about, and sign it as an affidavit or a legal witness statement, so to speak. So we're going to try to do the best we can with this conference, and so we can get a lot of mainstream news coverage on it.
That's fantastic. I think that's a wonderful idea. And, you know, getting back to this government. You don't even know whether it's government, military, or a combination, or black budget deal. But do you think the undisclosed, huge black budget that the military has should be more transparent to the elected officials of our government, such as the Ways and Means Committee?
Well, absolutely, I think so. But what are the chances? It's really going to take a major effort. I'll refer you to, I think I referenced it in my book, but it was Committee on Secrecy. I think it was 1997. But in there it talks about how easy it is to dupe Congress oversight committees overseeing black budget programs. In fact, I can tell you from personal experience, when I was at one of my reunions in the Air Force Academy, I went to a reunion, one of my classmates had gotten to a position where he was in charge of a program that had a black budget. It was a black program. And he was telling us how easy it was to pull the wool over congressional oversight. Basically, all they have to do is give some schedules and when they're going to try to meet some deadlines and ask for money and really not go into too much detail. So the whole issue of secrecy, and this is another thing that the public can do, is attack the issue of secrecy. There's too much government secrecy. And my hat's off to Obama if he accomplishes what he's proposing, and that is to make the government more open. But right now, pretty much, if you've got a black budget program in the military, you can do pretty much whatever you want without too many people saying anything about it.
Yeah, because not many people would know what you're doing.
Right.
You said a question from our virtual auditorium, and this one's from Gossamer777. And Gossamer would like to know if you think the national security explanation is overused by the intelligence agencies and military to hide stuff from the American people and the elected officials.
Absolutely, yes. It is way overused. I think I mentioned, let's see, maybe it's in that document I mentioned, but there are over a million people in government that are authorized to classify information.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's correct. It's just way overused, the issue of national security. I mean, what the heck does that mean anyway, and by whose definition do we establish there's a national security issue? And then once something is classified, it takes an act of God to declassify it. You know, like I said, the issue of security is really an important one, and one that we need to start hacking away at. I talk about in my book about secrecy by that. The government hires a lot of scientists, and they have them work on projects, but they classify the information they get. And these are projects involving the environment or things like that. It's not so much a weapons project, but it's just science, basic science that is classified. And that's not right. I mean, should the government be classifying basic science? Science that we discover things scientifically, it's just not right. So, and as a matter of fact, there was a recent article I read within the last 2 weeks about British scientists suing the British government over the classifying of basic science that they've been working on. So this is still an issue.
Basic science being classified? That,
right.
That just doesn't sound right. I mean, what could be so secret about just a basic science study?
Well, some military person says, well, this is related to a potential weapons system, maybe. And so we've got to classify the basic science around that. So,
I'm baffled by that line of thinking. I have to commend you on this book. It is very thorough. It is about one of the most thorough books on any one case I have ever seen. I mean, you've got footnotes for every chapter. I mean, it's just very well done. I applaud you and James Klotz on the work you guys did. It's a fantastic book.
Thank you.
And I still can't get over all these documents. That's you know, I mean, even going so far as to showing a cutaway drawing of a typical Minuteman launch facility.
Yes, and I must say that none of those documents are classified. They're available. They're in the public domain. So if the CIA is listening, none of those are classified. Okay.
Oh, if they were, then you would have been in big trouble, right?
Right.
We wouldn't be speaking now if they were. But I am serious that there's what? Gosh, over 100 pages of documents alone in here.
Yes. And I must give most of the credit for that to James Klotz. He's a terrific investigator. And he spent a lot of time writing a lot of letters to the Air Force and other government agencies and other people within the UFO community, like the Center for UFO Studies, Mark Rodiger's group, in attaining these documents. So my hat's off to him, really. He did most of the much more work than I did on that.
It's well put together. Thank you, David, for reminding me. We had met Michael Stratt at the crash retrieval conference in Las Vegas this last weekend,
mm-hmm.
And he's done work on strange Air Force craft that many people don't even know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if in his work with some aerospace and aircraft companies, I'm wondering if did he ever see any weird test craft? Or if you have seen any weird test craft? That is, if you're allowed to answer.
I worked in the Air Force. Like I said, I was on the Titan III missile program. I was in propulsion for that. And then as a civilian, I worked for the Federal Aviation Administration on aircraft for about 23 years. And so those were civilian aircraft, no military. I'll tell you, the strangest aircraft I saw was just about a month ago when I toured Edwards Air Force Base. And they had a very strange-looking small airplane that had delta wings, but it looked a little like a UFO, too, but not exactly. But it did have a regular propulsion system, but it was one of the advanced fighters. I can't remember the name of it now. But I have no doubt that the Air Force has been working on very unusual aircraft and possibly even using technology that they've acquired from alien spacecraft that have been captured. And I have no doubt that they have captured alien craft and gotten some of the technology from that or tried to understand it and tried to experiment with it.
That's amazing. Like this delta wing craft, is it more triangular, in other words?
Yeah, it's more triangular and it's small. And if you look at it in the right way, it kind of looks like a UFO with a little bulb on top. But anyway, this was on a tour of Edwards Air Force Base that I just happened to take a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a military aircraft nut myself. I've got so many books in the bookcase on military aircraft from World War One up. Oh gosh, let's see, where to go next? Let's see. Out of the whole incident that happened there, excuse me, in 1967 at Malmstrom, did you ever think that during that time, after the minute the topside guy had told you that there were UFOs out here and they were hovering over the facilities, did you ever think that, this is the Russians, they've come in with something weird to throw us off, or that it was some kind of an invasion or something?
Like I said, after that second phone call, I felt that our missiles were going to be affected somehow. Now, whether or not I actually had a conscious thought that it was the Russians, I don't think I did, but it felt like a threat. It felt like some kind of a threat was going on upstairs, so I was pretty much shocked, and that's why I immediately went to talk to my commander about it, and then our missiles shut down. So we were kind of in a very active mode, very alert at that point of a possible threat to the facility. And so, we were at our, tried to work at our best. The possibility did cross my mind that the guard was not telling us the truth. And so the first thing I did when I got upstairs, we were relieved that morning by another crew, and we had to take a little elevator upstairs. First thing I did was confront this guard. I went right up to him, nose to nose, and asked him if what he told me had happened really happened. And he swore up and down absolutely that he was not trying to put one over on us. He was telling the truth, and I believed him. Like I said, I was nose to nose to him, basically I put him at attention and made sure he was, telling us the truth. And he, again, I tried to get him to describe the craft, the object, and he said, it was some 40 feet long, but it was oval shaped and it was pulsating a red glow, and he had a hard time discerning any physical features of the object other than it was oval shaped and pulsating this reddish glow.
Wow. You also mentioned in the book that when the incident was over and you went to go tell your superior, or were you and your partner?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a two-man team down there, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That you went, you had to go to your superiors and tell them, this is what happened. Topside guys said these objects were out there and all this. What was the reaction of your superiors? And I'll ask my second question after you're done answering the first.
Yeah, my superior was the squadron commander, Colonel Eldridge, and I walked into his office. I knew Colonel Eldridge, you know, pretty well on a friendly basis with him. So I walked into his office, and he was white as a sheet. I tell you, he was just drained. Like I said, there was a man from AFOSI in the office with him. And it was almost as if, what I said to him was, what the heck happened? You know, basically in those, something like that. This guy was an ex-World War II B-17 pilot. He had fought World War II, flew missions over Europe, B-17s. He was a combat veteran, and he was white as a sheet, and he was shaking his head, and he said, "I don't know." And so it was definitely not an Air Force exercise. That's what I got from that. Yeah, if it had been some kind of a readiness test or an exercise that the Air Force had dreamed up, he would have told me. I knew him that well. And basically we kind of started telling him our, you know, what happened down there. But it was almost like he already knew, or he didn't seem all that interested in the details. And again, this to me confirms the probability that this is what happened to us was very much similar to what happened at Echo Flight, which had happened a week earlier. So he probably was privy to that information. Pretty soon the AFOSI guy tells us, you know, he gives us the riot act and says you have to sign these documents and not talk to anybody about this. And we mean anybody, not even your wives, none of your Air Force officers, no airmen, nobody. Absolutely nobody are you to speak to about this. So that essentially shut us up.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and I want to get this last question in real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You also stated in your book that you were never debriefed on the incident.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas of why you were never debriefed, and you think on such an incident, an important incident such as this, that you would have been?
Absolutely, we should have been debriefed. Like I said, we were handling the most advanced strategic weapons at the time, you know, nuclear tip intercontinental ballistic missiles, and every time we went on alert, we were given details, a lot of minute details as to what kind of improvements were being made, what kind of activities were going on in the field, and what we should, you know, be aware of, et cetera, et cetera. We were briefed, like I said, every 3 days about the technical aspects of these weapons. And like I said, in 2 years after this incident happened, we were never debriefed about our incidents, our own incidents. And the reason, one of the primary reasons, is because in 1967, like I said, in 1967, the Conan Committee was in full swing in supposedly investigating the UFO issue involving military facilities, the Air Force and the UFOs. And the Air Force did not want any more people with information about this than necessary. So, you know, they were probably afraid that we might be asked to be interviewed by the Conan Committee investigators. But like I said, they had that end of it pretty well tied up. I think there was a whitewash from the beginning.
Well, Kim, unfortunately, we're out of time. But if you'd like to get your email address out again, so those who were involved with this incident that haven't yet come forward, would you like to give that out again, please?
You bet. It's rsolace15 at roadrunner.com.
And please, if you had any involvement in Malmstrom, or even Minot, for that matter.
Any military installation especially nukes are involved, we'd appreciate hearing from you.
And, most definitely.
Okay.
And thank you, Robert, for joining us tonight. 2 hours never seems to be enough.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you, Dee.
Oh, you're very welcome. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in and all of those who joined us here in the Pal Talk Award Auditorium. You guys come up with some really good questions tonight. I'm really proud of you. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be authors Robert Hill, Ph.D., and Eduardo Castro, M.D. And please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be Michael Schratt. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.